Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A new music festival is coming to Seattle. It is an idea from local billionaire Paul Allen. Early next summer, for 3 days, Pioneer Square will host a bunch of live shows at a conference for people in the music industry. One of the goals of the Upstream Festival is to help local artists stay here and make a living from their music. I asked music journalist and Seattle native Ann Powers, how come Seattle bands can't do that now?
Historically, the U.S. has had amazing regional scenes, but the American recording industry has been centered in just a couple of cities. Let's say three cities, New York, Los Angeles, and Nashville, Tennessee, where country music lives. There have been moments when other cities, say Detroit, for example, had a great recording scene. But the industry and many of the major studios, the places where music is not maybe initially created, but recorded, committed to tape, to vinyl or whatever, those have not always been in places like Seattle. Now that's changing so much, and that's why I think it's actually prescient to say this could be a time when bands do stay in their hometowns. Happening more and more.
Yes, this is a time of change. Let's talk about how this festival, Upstream, is involved in that. How does the festival want to make Seattle more of a center of recording?
Well, the festival wants to highlight what Seattle already is, which is a great place for creative people to live and work. I think it's an interesting moment for Paul Allen. Full disclosure, my former employer, I used to work at Experience Music Project. I think it's an interesting moment for Allen to be creating this festival because there are challenges within Seattle now with rising rents and costs that have, because of the booming economy for creatives. So in a way, this is it's a way of fighting back against creative people, artists, specifically, who might be leaving the town. At the same time, Seattle has never been more in the national and international spotlight. If you think about in the 90s when Seattle rock really dominated the zeitgeist, that was, you know, a small event next to Seattle culturally now as it stands on the world scale, where it's not only music, it's also obviously tech, it's a beautiful place to live. It's a fast-changing population. All of those things have made the world aware of Seattle in new ways, and that seems like one reason why doing a festival like this might work.
Against that backdrop, what is going to happen at this Upstream Festival next year that would advance that goal of making it possible for the music scene to stay here instead of being L.A., New York, Nashville?
I think there's a lot of potential for Upstream to become a great event that highlights Pacific Northwest musicians. Whether or not it becomes a root cause for musicians to stay in Seattle is another matter. South by Southwest in Austin, for example, which is probably the best known city-based, urban-based music festival in the world, has done so much for the city of Austin, but has it really kept Austin musicians in town? I don't really think that's been the effect. It's drawn attention to the city. At the same time, as South by Southwest has grown, in fact, Austin musicians are less highlighted within that festival. So I see Upstream as having the potential to be part of a kind of larger project that would also have to include initiatives that make it easier for artists to stay in Seattle through perhaps subsidized housing or other programs, you know, that would help them year-round. What I do think Upstream can accomplish is drawing attention to deserving local artists. And Seattle's scene is so diverse, and it's only associated in the minds of people elsewhere with a few things, right? Obviously, the great legacy of Northwest rock. I think, you know, Seattle hip-hop has definitely become better known on a wider scale because of Macklemore's success. But there's so much more happening in Seattle. And as a native Seattleite, what I'd love to see is people coming from all over and hearing great jazz, hearing great indie pop, hearing great singer-songwriters, hearing great R&B, all of those kinds of artists who are also in Seattle who deserve a larger hearing.
Now let's focus on another goal, stated goal of next year's Upstream Music Festival. The organizer says that he wants to focus on how artists can make money now that the traditional record sales model has gone away. I'd like to know, how can they?
Well, isn't this the million-dollar question, Bill? How do artists make money? How do they even survive and sustain themselves in a totally different music industry? And I think Seattle's an interesting setting to talk about it. I know Upstream is going to have a whole conference component as well as the music festival aspect, and I hope to see dialogues among artists, people who've worked in the more conventional music industry, including those leaders at labels like Sub Pop, who really have been major innovators in the music business, and Hardly Art, another great local label. And I'd like to see those people in dialogue with representatives from, you know, giant corporations like Amazon, for example, or Microsoft, these Seattle-based corporations that have both been part of the reason why it's become hard for artists to earn a living and also offer the promise of new ways to make a living. So it's possible the dialogue could get a little tense sometimes, but I think if everyone's open and really thinking about change and putting artists' interests first, which honestly has historically rarely happened in the music industry, then something really good can come out of this conference and festival.
Ann Powers, music journalist. She, too, left Seattle. She's in Nashville now. We're talking about the Upstream Music Fest that's going to happen in May of next year in Seattle's Pioneer Square. Little local music for you there. That's Taco Cat with the song Cat Fancy. Bear with me. Cats will become relevant in just a moment. A big fact of life in Seattle is that people keep coming here, right? We're always talking about people arriving. Ben and Emily Huh came here from the Midwest, and they hit it big by building an internet pipeline that fed cat pictures and videos to bored people at work.
Kind of responsible for wasting a lot of people's time during workplace, so sorry, bosses.
Their empire was called The Cheeseburger Network. You've seen it. Adorable kitten with a caption that says something like, I has a sad. Cheeseburger Network. Ben founded that company here in Seattle, but now they're leaving for San Francisco. And since we're always telling you about all the people coming here, we wanted to know, Ben and Emily, why would you leave?
I'll let Ben take that because I know Ben.
Yeah.
Oh, I sense Ben is more into this plan than Emily is.
Yeah. You can say that. You know, it's been 11 amazing years here. When life gives you a moment to take pause, which, you know, for me was stepping down from the Cheeseburger Network. And now I have no responsibilities here. I only have the fun stuff.
That sounds awful.
It sounds terrible. So we actually took a year off and we traveled to 37 countries and 7 continents and we came back about a month ago. And during that trip, I started feeling like I was going to go home and be complacent. And so the reason I left Chicago was the same thing. I felt this idea that if I stayed here, things would be really nice. But I don't want nice. I want an adventure.
And I'm going along with that adventure. Well, I laugh because Ben actually broached this subject. We were actually in Myanmar while we were traveling Christmas Day, and we're sitting, and Ben goes, how do you feel about us moving to San Francisco? I kind of looked at him and was like, you know, and we've been married already for, you know, almost 10 years, so I kind of wasn't surprised, and I said, I guess we're doing this, huh? So I'm always along for a new adventure and a new change, so yeah, I'm excited, but sad at the same time.
So you're not blaming Seattle? because we talk a lot here about how Seattle has changed. Seattle has lost its soul. Seattle has this and that. Did Seattle do anything to you while you were here?
I think if you talked to the Salish Indians and they had like five extra people who were born that year, they would have said the same thing. We have lost our soul.
Right. There goes the neighborhood.
There goes the neighborhood. This is a time immemorial problem where people complain about what they have. I mean, it sounds like I'm complaining about what I have, but...
You're complaining about people who complain about what they have.
It's very meta. But it's a little different. I don't think Seattle has that problem. What Seattle does have is a problem with its infrastructure and a lot of the West Coast city problems Seattle has in droves, right? Like you have the suburbs preventing public transportation being built. You have a lack of infrastructure. You have schools that are not being properly funded. These are fundamental issues that are – every city has it, particularly San Francisco in droves. So I'm clearly not leaving Seattle for those reasons.
Yeah. You're going from traffic to traffic. Expensive to more expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a frying pan into the studio apartment frying pan.
What about you, Emily? What did Seattle ever do to you?
Provided me a great home with wonderful people. No, Seattle's been wonderful. Definitely, I think, you know, in these last 10 years, I mean, the first 2 years, it was harder, but these last 8 years have been wonderful. You know, it actually has been really kind of fun and interesting to watch the change, especially we were gone this year. So every time we'd kind of come back, we're like, oh, wow, that's new.
You like new. That's the thing. You don't want to be complacent, but Seattle's changing. It's dynamic. It's tearing stuff down. It's building stuff up. How come there's not enough go-go energy here for you?
It's not that there isn't enough energy, clearly. The center of gravity for industry here is gravitating towards just a few companies. And it's always been that way, like Boeing, Microsoft, Amazon. Like those are the companies that have really held the center of power, and I don't see that diversifying. And it needs to do so more in order for this to be an even more vibrant city.
Should we be worried, by the way? Is this an ominous sign that a tech success wants to get out of here?
No, I don't think so. I certainly don't think there's a growth problem here in terms of business. I think it has a really bright future, especially because I think cost of living is so much lower here that it's drawing talent. Right. And the city's actually doing something about it. The city's actually building infrastructure, letting people build buildings to at least try to contain some of the problems that have to do with high rents and housing prices.
So you won't miss the traffic.
Definitely.
You won't miss the winters, it sounds like. What will you miss the most?
I will miss seeing Mount Rainier always in the background. Just seeing that is every day or almost every day in the distance has been something kind of reassuring for me.
Yeah. I will miss my routine because if I move, I will have to develop a new routine. It's going to throw me off my game. But
you have a love-hate relationship with that,
that's
sounds
right.
like.
That's right. Yeah, I want to wake up in the morning, grab my coffee, look out my back window and see the beautiful view and the sky and go to work or go work with people that I've really respected and came to love for the last 10 years of my life. And I will also... And this is a good thing. I will miss my role in the community. Like I have built a company here and it's been successful. So people seek you out and they talk to you and they ask you for advice. And if I want to go meet somebody in tech, then it's easy for me to do. And that's precisely what I don't want. I want to have a beginner's mind. I want to go look at something new and say, I know nothing about it. Where do I get started? And it's harder for me to do that here. Versus somewhere else.
Emily, did you make a pro-Seattle argument? What's the pro-Seattle pitch?
Oh, well, there's too many. I mean, I think, one, we're going to miss all our friends and community, and especially we just sold our condo, and I've been looking at the San Francisco apartments, and it's just not quite the same. So I keep on saying, we're giving up our great condo here. And there's just a lot of different arguments that, like food, the ease of kind of the city.
We're privileged here, right? I mean, that term is a little bit loaded, especially kind of this, year. But we're privileged. Like, we have access to things that we didn't have 10 years ago. We have friends. If you want to go to a restaurant opening, if you want to get a reservation, if you want to go get that concert ticket, like, we can do those things.
That's important because a lot of people talk about getting priced out of Seattle and Seattle being...
We bought our condo in November of 2009, right? So, like... We have clearly taken advantage of the opportunities that were given to us. And we're very, very grateful for that. But that's not what life is about.
Well, let's talk about what life is about. Because you talk about complacency and routine, and you don't want things too easy. What's the right amount of time to be in Seattle before you really should force yourself to go?
Is it never?
Maybe just 12 years. Can we just add on another year or 2 years?
House has been sold.
I do have to say, probably like that 10 to 15 year mark, I would say, for Seattle. Maybe I'm leaning more towards the 15 year.
But people listening to you might also, maybe further back in their minds than what you're doing, might be thinking about, yeah, I know this place. It's comfortable. Is that altogether good?
There's nothing wrong with being comfortable, right? But it's a question of the life you want, right? We don't have children. We don't have these things that are external to us that makes us provide for someone else here, right? We can pick up and move anytime. So our attachment to Seattle was our company, right? And when that ended, like, life gave you an opportunity. And if I start another company now, that's another, you know, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, right? So it's not how long has it been. It's when you see the gap in the clouds, you go through it. And this is the gap in the clouds. I think there's a lot of value to staying in some place for the rest of your life, if that's what you want, right? But if you ever feel that desire to experience something different and are willing to pay the price of discomfort, you should absolutely pursue that. You will, I think, become a better person for it.
Pry yourself away from Mount Rainier.
Although we had dinner with some friends and they said, 6 months, you'll be back. They also are not fans of San Francisco, so they might be a little...
Really? They said, I know you guys, Emily and Ben. I give you half a year.
I've heard that before.
Any chance? You're coming back, right?
I would put that at negligible.
Really?
Yes.
You going to talk smack about Seattle when you get to San Francisco?
No.
You know, that's... So here's a weird relationship between San Francisco and Seattle. San Francisco doesn't care that Seattle exists.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Seattle really, really, really cares about what San Francisco thinks of Seattle. That needs to stop. Right? That's that's bizarre, right? It's like, hey guys, they're cities. They're not like boyfriend, girlfriend. Like, you're not talking smack about your ex.
Right. No, that's true. I was at a radio conference where we were always talking about how we're better than TV for all these reasons. And then I went to a TV conference. Nobody was talking about radio. So you've got one final summer in Seattle.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, we've already done our trip to Portland, and then we're actually headed to Vancouver. Sorry.
Last summer in Seattle, must do Portland.
Sorry. We're headed to Vancouver this weekend. Canada.
Vancouver.
Last summer in
Before
the
Before you leave town, leave town.
Well, we had did all the Pacific Northwest kind of spots.
Yeah, I get it.
And yeah, we definitely have our... list of restaurants we're going to.
Hit the big restaurants.
Yeah. Yes.
Take the Northwest trips. Visit the other places up here, the other jewels in the crown.
Right.
Any other Seattle on the way out?
I am training to get my instrument rating for my pilot's license.
Everybody needs to do that before they leave Seattle.
Right, right. Well, it's the place of birth of aviation, well, kind of, aviation industry. So, like, yeah, right. What a great place to get your pilot's license again.
Only one good thing that will come out of moving to San Francisco is... And sorry to all the Seattle Seahawks fans, but we are more 49ers fans.
What?
No.
Oh. You did what?
Sorry.
Now we can't come back.
I don't know. We can't. Well, now it's like we're leaving.
We chased
and
out of town.
Clearly said we're not going to be coming back, but, you know, so we won't have to kind of pretend.
Oh, my God.
Wow. You just burned that floating bridge.
I know.
All righty. Well, folks.
Well, listen, I haven't met you before, Emily. I've met you, Ben. We're going to miss you. I think this area loses a little something of your spirit, of your success, of your energy, of your warmth. We're going to be okay. We're going to pick ourselves up. But, you know, I'm sorry to see you go on Seattle's behalf.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Bill.
Yep, people do leave Seattle, like Ben and Emily Huff, founders at the Cheeseburger Network. Now, how about you? Are you... just about to skip town? Considering it? We would like to know why. So before you go, tell us, why are you leaving us? Did something happen? Do you not love us? Did we not love you enough? Tell us your story about leaving Seattle. You can send us an email at record@kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. This is KUOW's The Record. We're catching you up on the news, and we're figuring out why it matters. Last week, Seattle became the third city in America to crack down on gay conversion therapy. That's an issue very close to writer Garrett Conley. He grew up in Arkansas, the son of a pastor. When he was 18, his parents found out he was gay and gave him an ultimatum. Go to gay conversion therapy or you are out of the family. So Conley went to a place called Love in Action in Memphis.
We would sit around in a group full of people, and these people could be dealing with pedophilia, bestiality, marriage issues, etc., from ages, you know, teenagers to adults. And we were all placed together, and we would be asked to stand up and deliver an account of an instance of sexual sin, as it was described, or some sort of sexual thought that we'd had. And so I would recount a story with not too much detail, and then I would basically be asked to apply a Bible verse onto my story so that it could help me get over any urges that I had.
Garrett didn't want to be exiled from his family, so he tried to do what he was asked at Love in Action. But then the counselor asked him to do something, and he couldn't make himself do it.
I was asked to do this activity in which I had to envision my father in an empty chair across from me in front of everyone. And the counselor at the time, he said, "I want you to yell at your father and get angry at your father." And my father and I have a complicated relationship. He's a preacher, but I do very much love him and have never really been that angry with him. And so I said to the counselor, "I'm not angry. I don't want to shout at this chair. This feels really stupid." And he challenged me at that moment and said that I was holding back and that I'd never wanted to actually do any of this therapy and that there was something suspicious about me. And I stood up from the chair that I was sitting in and I said, "Well, I don't want to continue this. This is stupid." And they said, "Well, you know, I think that you're filled with sin and blah, blah, blah. You need a lot more therapy." And I just walked out. And I asked the receptionist to give me back my phone. And he was like, "No, you don't need your phone back." And I said, "Well, I need to call my mom. This is an emergency." And so he gave me my phone and I called my mom and she came to pick me up. And they tried to convince her that I was rebellious and that I needed 3 months or a year or I needed to drop out of college and that it was severe, my case of homosexuality. And she finally snapped because she could see how, you know, zealous they were at this point. And she said, "What are your qualifications? I can't believe I haven't asked this before." And one of the counselors said, "Well, I'm a marriage counselor and I went through Alcoholics Anonymous." And she said, "What is a former alcoholic doing telling my son how to be straight?" And he was like, "Well, I mean, I think that the programs are very similar." And so she, at that point, she was done. And so we were driving away and we didn't know exactly what to do. And I just became really erratic in the car. And I said, well, I didn't say anything. I started just sort of breaking down. And my mom turned to me and she said, "Are you going to commit suicide?" Because she'd heard that a lot of people were suicidal. And I said, "Yes." And I don't know if I actually believed I was going to commit suicide at that point, but I knew that that answer would get me out of there. And so from that point on, you know, it's been a long journey, but I think that was the turning point for her when she realized, like, that it had gotten to such a stage where she could lose her son instead of just have a gay son.
What effect did gay conversion therapy have on you?
Well, it took me about a decade to really talk about it openly. I would tell a few friends, with partners. I know that a lot of the reasons I wasn't able to sustain some long-term relationships were that I would sometimes feel a sense of shame that would come back. And, you know, it's hard to explain to a partner why you might be disgusted with them suddenly. Like, you know, nobody wants to hear that. And if you say to someone, "Okay, well, it's because I was in conversion therapy and I feel like touching you would be a disgusting thing and maybe evil," that's not, you know, that's not sexy. And so it's kind of hard to maintain a relationship if someone has no idea what you're talking about or didn't go through something like that, which, you know, most LGBTQ people in our country have had some experience of bigotry. But I think the degree to which I was subjected to some of these thought patterns makes it difficult sometimes to connect to other people.
You know, Garrett, to somebody who's far away from this world, like a Seattle secular liberal, it barely sounds real.
I know. This is the thing. Like, pop culture has absorbed the fact that these places exist, but it's always as a joke because it does sound insane whenever I even begin to talk about it. There are these groups, these secret Facebook groups that I belonged to when I started to research my own memoir. And the thing that got me, I used to make light of it as well, but I would read these stories about people who'd committed suicide or people who knew someone who committed suicide or, you know, people who still couldn't touch their partners because they'd been taught that it was evil. And I would think somebody has to tell the real story because it's not, you know, we can make fun of the fact that these things exist, but we also live in a period of time in which 40% of all youth homeless are LGBTQ, which is like epidemic level. So parents are kicking their kids out of their houses. And currently, the GOP platform even has language that supports conversion therapy.
What happened to your religious faith?
Well, I feel like it was taken from me. I had such a close relationship with what I believed to be God and a feeling of sort of universal love at certain points in my life. And there's nothing that can really rival religious experience in terms of like endorphins kicking in. And I feel sort of locked out of that. I can't really go into a church and feel comfortable anymore.
Seattle just became the third city in America to ban gay conversion therapy. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think it's fantastic. You know, there are only 5 states that have banned it. I would like for the entire country to ban conversion therapy. I think I meet with many people who are incredulous at the fact that it's not banned everywhere. I mean, the idea that this could be a credible practice is sort of insane. And so I do, while I celebrate Seattle doing this ban, I think it's so fantastic. I also am incredibly frustrated at the fact that other cities have not done so.
Garrett Connolly's memoir about gay conversion therapy is called Boy Erased. He told me he dedicated his book to his parents. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. As the National Park Service celebrates its 100th anniversary this month, we're taking a closer look at the parks here in Washington. Local poet Tim McNulty describes the Olympic National Park as an intricate tracery of life forms and waterways, each lending beauty and complexity to the whole. McNulty has lived on the Olympic Peninsula for 45 years, but it was his first trip up Mount Olympus that solidified his love for the park.
It's a long hike, and the beauty of the forest can really seep into you. The kind of snow-capped peaks of the Bailey Range to the east and the long valley of the Ho River west, distant gleam of the Pacific, it all struck me as all of a place, all of a piece almost, from ocean to mountains and glaciers, kind of an entire wilderness ecosystem that was remarkably intact. And over the years, as I've explored and learned more about this place, that feeling has only deepened.
You've written, Tim, that to immerse yourself in the Olympic National Park is to step into a larger story. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what that probably referred to was, you know, the larger stories, the cycles, the great cycles of water and land and life. And then the evolution, or really co-evolution of animals and salmon with their habitats really kind of reminds me that we're part of that process, and it's wonderful to recognize this whole magical place as home.
You say that Olympic National Park has survived the odds.
Oh, it has. Yeah, you know, the park really survived the 19th century assault of mining and logging and railroad building, and that altered so much of the West. The peninsula's isolated locale out here on the far end. It was just far enough for markets and railheads for humans not to have really, you know, had a huge play in altering this landscape. So by the 1930s, when Americans were coming to the understanding that we're losing our original forests, we're losing our wild rivers, there was enough of the original ecosystem here to save and make a park large enough to preserve some of those forests and some of those processes for the future.
What makes the Olympics unique to Washington State?
Well, they're unique because, they're a small, isolated range of coastal mountains, yet that encompass glacier-clad peaks like the High Cascades, a dozen wild, free-flowing rivers, one of the greatest temperate old-growth forest preserves in North America, forests that harbor fairly intact communities of wildlife and wild salmon. It's all bounded by 70 miles of undeveloped Pacific coastline, offshore islands, intertidal communities. And the park is recognized as a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve and a World Heritage Site. It's a wild and beautiful corner of the earth adjacent to a thriving urban area that's luckily been preserved for the future.
Have you ever had a bad time in Olympic National Park?
Oh, even the bad times are good times. Yeah, I've been wet and cold plenty. Lost on occasion. You know, they're all good memories.
Do you have a favorite Olympic National Park story?
Some of my best memories of traveling in the park are backpacking with my daughter when she was a little girl, and every year being able to venture a little more deeply into the wilderness, until one year we were able to go to a very remote kind of hidden lake off the High Divide. We had some wonderful encounters with some bears that were there that I've written about. But
how wonderful can a bear encounter be?
Pretty wonderful when they're flipping huge boulders down the slope and digging around for grubs, and we're sitting well out of their way in our camp down by a small lake watching them through binoculars and at closer range as they're going about feeding during the summer.
We've talked a lot about Olympic National Park itself. What is your relationship with the park?
I moved here as a young man because of the park, because I was attracted to the diversity and the wildness and the beauty of the park. I was maybe a hopeful poet and writer at the time, and looking for a landscape that I could immerse myself into that would inspire me, perhaps. And since then, the park and really the surrounding ecosystem have become central to my life as a poet, as an essayist, as a naturalist. So it's hard for me to think of a way that a part of my life that Olympic National Park has not touched in a deep way.
For those of us who don't know Olympic National Park, what do you recommend we do?
It's a very diverse park, and of course it depends on the season. For the summer season, people are drawn to the high country, either day trips up to Hurricane Ridge or longer trips into the high mountains. Spring and fall, the western forest trails, the temperate rainforest trails, are a wonderful experience. Year round, you could visit the Olympic coast. Particularly in winter, it comes alive with storms. My suggestion is that wherever you go, just take some time to steep yourself into this landscape, to be open to the sights and sounds and smells and textures around you, to give yourself over to this place, whether it be just for an afternoon or for a multi-day trip, and just let some of the magic sink into you.
Tim McNulty lives in Sequim. His book is called Olympic National Park, A Natural History. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. And let's stay out of doors here for just a moment, because we're about to take a shower in shooting stars. The annual Perseid meteor shower peaks tonight and early tomorrow. Could be 200 meteors per hour. Primetime viewing starts at about 1 a.m. And I've seen several people on Reddit Seattle wondering where to go in the city to view it. Sadly, light pollution is going to make that difficult. It's hard to see a lot when you're in the city limits, but Green Lake Park is open 24 hours, so if you can't get out of town, that's worth a shot. Or if you prefer to watch from bed, because it is 1 in the morning, NASA will be streaming live video, which I'm sure is just as enthralling as seeing it in person. Anyway, we're tweeting out a link to where you'll find that video at KUOW. Happy stargazing. Thanks for tuning into The Record here on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Are U.S. elections rigged? Trump and Sanders seemed to think so during their primaries, and now that both parties have named their nominees, Trump says the election against Hillary Clinton will certainly be rigged against him. Some people have latched onto that idea. In a recent poll in North Carolina, 69% of Trump's backers said that a Clinton win would mean a rigged election. Can an election, say the one in November in Washington state, be stolen? KUOW's Kim Malcolm took that question to Washington Secretary of State Kim Wyman, and Wyman told her there are multiple layers in our state system to guard against election fraud. You mail your ballot in, they check your signature, and then...
Once we've checked your signature, we give you credit for voting. And what that means is we're saying that, you know, Kim Wyman has returned a ballot in the primary election. So if another ballot with my name on it comes through, that would be held aside and then sent to the canvassing board to, you know, to be followed up on and make sure that there wasn't any kind of, you know, attempt to do voter fraud or to vote twice or whatever. But we also are just doing safeguards to make sure that the ballots that are returned were ballots that were issued by the county. And ironically, that was the ballot from the election that we're currently in. Every election office in this state receives ballots randomly from earlier elections.
Oh.
I've seen election ballots from 2 and 3 years prior, and I think it's just well-intentioned voters who, you know, had it in their drawer or something and then returned it. But that's just kind of one example of some of the odd things that election officials see. And really what they're trying to do is they can create this audit trail. I think that's the easiest way to explain it. They're doing everything from start to finish so that any given ballot, you could tell who's had access to it, what happened to that ballot, and if it wasn't counted, why it was rejected. And that's really what they're building, so that if you ever get into an election that's called into question, they can recreate those steps and really instill confidence in the voters.
We fill out paper ballots, but what about an electronic attack? Could our state computer systems be compromised in some way to potentially alter an outcome?
Well, and that's another kind of layer of our security that we have in place. So we have essentially two systems in each county that are doing elections. One is the election management system, and that's where we're looking you up, we're checking your signature against it, we're giving you credit for voting. The other side is a tabulation system, and that system in all 39 counties is not attached to the internet in any way. So people can't just randomly hack into that system from the outside. They would have to physically get to the system, which, you know, in each county is in a secure server room and everything. So it like a bank, you know, a bank, someone could, I guess, rob a bank if they really wanted to. You have a lot of security on the front end to prevent it. But if someone really wants to rob a bank, they could. And so you have things to detect that robbery on the back end and prosecute people that did it. So, you know, our system is kind of built that way. We're trying to prevent it and make it secure. But, you know, if somebody really wants to do it, I'm sure they could.
Secretary Wyman, this campaign season, we've seen a lot of rhetoric about rigged politics from both parties. Bernie Sanders supporters have argued that the system was weighed against them in the primaries. Donald Trump has suggested that the November elections could be rigged. As an elections official, how do you respond to that kind of rhetoric?
Well, I've been an elections administrator for over 20 years, and in that time, I have yet to find a winner in an election who makes any kind of allegation that people have somehow, you know, cheated or counted ballots in a way that favored them. So it's an easy thing to throw out that, oh, the system is rigged and that's why people lose or whatever. But the reality is, particularly on a national level, if you look across the country, there are about 9,000 voting jurisdictions that have many times independently elected officials like myself who are overseeing elections. So to make a blanket assessment that there's some sort of rigged system and that the majority of these people are all in it together to help one side or the other is ludicrous.
What would you say to voters to give them confidence in the system come November?
The strength of Washington's system is that we have paper ballots. And, you know, voters are mailed ballots to their homes, they fill them out, they return them, and those ballots are kept for a minimum of 22 months and in some cases longer. So we can always physically go back to those ballots and count them. If there's ever a question of programming or whether a system was hacked or whether somebody was doing something illegally, we can count those ballots. We could do that.
Kim Wyman is the Washington Secretary of State. She also told Kim that her department has thoroughly tested the voting system here, including running fake ballot counts to make sure that votes get counted correctly. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Have you ever heard a song that changed your life? Bob Boylan has. He is the host and the creator of NPR's All Songs Considered, and he's not alone here. Boylan interviewed dozens of musicians about what songs changed their lives, and he wrote up their answers in his new book, Your Song Changed My Life. Boylan told Jeannie Yandel the song that changed his life is A Day in the Life by the Beatles.
John Lennon said to George Martin, their producer, I want you to imagine the end of the world and make it so in music. And that's not the exact quote, but that's the essence of it. And George Martin grabbed an orchestra of about 40 people. He recorded them doing something what he imagined to be the end of the world, this climactic build. And then it recorded them again and again and again and then meshed them all together. And you have this like 160-piece string thing. And before that song, I'd never heard anything that sounded like it. But lyrically, there are two things that happen in that song. One is, there are two songs I think of as in a day in the life. John Lennon's song that opens up, I read the news today, oh boy.
I read the news today, oh boy.
That song is about a few things, but the one thing that strikes me is it's about the death of somebody killed in a car crash. That person was Tara Brown. Tara Brown was a heir to the Guinness fortune and a very rich socialite, very handsome young man. Died, gone, car crash.
Who is mine out in a car? He didn't notice that the lights had changed.
Paul McCartney has another song within that song that he was working on that was, you know, woke up, fell out of bed.
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup.
It was the mundane, everyday bit of life that we all go through and really just, for the most part, we are and can be very bored by, and it's just, oh no, I got to do that again. But those two things juxtaposed, as the more I listened to that song, made me realize about the preciousness of life. And that even if you're just running to catch your bus, or you're just waking up and you're running late, it's still pretty darn good to be alive.
Bob, why did you want to ask musicians that same question? What song changed their lives?
You know, I don't know about you, but whenever I talk to musicians simply about their own music, they can get tired of answering some of those same questions. But I've always noticed that whenever I ask a musician about someone else's music, they just light up. And it's really fun. And so I wanted to do something that a book that had stories that had a similar theme, but that told me a lot about who they were without them telling me directly about who they were. And it really worked well. So I would do interviews with musicians, and then I would say, and then I'd look at the song they chose, look at the music they make, look at the artist who made the song that they chose, and just start to write an essay to connect all those little dots.
One of the musicians you talked to was
Dave Grohl, who he's probably best known around here as the drummer of Nirvana. I think he did something else after Nirvana, but I'm not really sure what it is.
Yeah,
most importantly, right, doesn't, I don't know. But you talked with him and asked him what song changed his life. What did he tell you?
One day, he went to Chicago and visited his Aunt Sherry and his cousin Tracy. And Aunt Sherry said to Tracy, who was a real punk kid, hey, take Dave and down to the punk show tonight. and Tracy basically looked at Dave and thought he was going to get his bottom kicked. But Dave winds up in the front of the stage for this group called Naked Ray Gun. Winds up with the singer like on his head. The Dave describes the decibel level of the guitars that are about 140 dB. And so he went back home and was really inspired to like say to his, he was, you know, drumming and banging on his mattresses and pillows as a drummer in his basement, but he wanted to make music with his friends that wasn't someone else's music. And he came home and he said, we're going to make our own music, we're going to do this thing. They all looked at him like he was nuts, but we all know that Dave Grohl is not nuts. And he was inspired, and a really, really inspired man.
Dave Grohl wasn't the only musician you talked to. Obviously, you talked to 35 different musicians about what songs inspired them, what songs changed their lives. So what do you know now about inspiration that you didn't know before?
It can come at any time, but often comes during teen years. There is something that we are more susceptible. I think it has to do with hormones that makes us more susceptible to things that are emotionally charged. I think there needs to be a sense of to be ready for it. So, for example, this wasn't a song that changed his life, but Jimmy Page moves into a house. We know Jimmy Page, right? Got some guitar player dude. And he moves into a house with his family when he's like a 7 or 8-year-old kid. There's a guitar in the house. The only thing in the house, right? It's an empty house. But it wasn't until he saw a kid at school play this song that he had loved hearing on the radio. It was a song called Rock Island Line.
Oh, well, a Rock Island Line, a she's a mighty good road. A Rock Island Line is a road to ride it.
He saw a friend at school play this song on his friend's guitar, and Paige thought, I have one of those in my closet. And he went back home, got that guitar, had strings on it, went to school, and the kid taught him how to play Rock Island Line. And the rest of the story we sort of know. But what I'm saying here is that there's a moment in time where things converge. Your emotions, everything is sort of ready for that moment of inspiration.
Bob Boylan, host and creator of NPR's All Songs Considered, bringing you the songs that changed musicians' life. He talked with Jeannie Yandel there on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information and life-changing music.